Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Tuesday, November 14th, 2023. Hi, Dave.
Hello, Melody. I bet you I know why you're upbeat today.
Tell me.
It's National CPI Day.
That's why I'm happy.
It is. I expected an oh boy. Will you give one to me?
Oh boy.
Thank you. We'll be talking more about that in a few minutes, so I'm just going to stop there and turn it back to you for today's market report.
Okay. Well, you know, we had a great day in gold today. It's still off the high, though, by $10. So literally it was up $26 on the day. Right now we're up 16 at 1963. Silver is up 79 cents at $23.18. Platinum was up $22 at $898. And palladium was up $34 at $1,042. The USDX took a tumble, 1.64. That's huge. That's huge. We're still at 104.02, but wow, what a drop. Crude oil was basically unchanged at 78.24. And going back to the USDX, it's 104.02, down 1.64. But the paper markets today were stupid, just literally stupid, on a report that doesn't even, you know. It's headlines, Dave, but the Dow is up 489 points. The S&P was up 84 points. Well, let me go back to the Dow. That's 1.5% for a 489-point pop. The S&P was up almost 2%, and that's an 84 point pop. The NASDAQ was up almost 2.5% at 326 points. So a huge day in the markets. And of course, everything was, you know, red across, green across the board, both in Europe, Asia. Hang Seng was lower just barely. So even the Asian markets, I mean, they weren't up big, but they were still in green territory. 10-year yield, that fell 0.183 at 4.449. And my natural gas was just down fractionally 3.097, but it was down 3%. So the S&P had notched the best day since April, and I guess it's all due to a very soft inflation report, Dave.
Yes, yes, yes. Some more good news for the Federal Reserve, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. So let's just take a peek at this before we chop it up. Inflation was flat in October from the previous month. This is a hopeful sign that high prices might be easing on the grip on the economy. Well, I thought we were having a great economy, so how is that a grip? Anyway, and giving another green light to the Fed to maybe stop raising interest rates. The consumer price index increased 3.2% from a year ago, despite being unchanged for the month, according to a seasonally adjusted numbers from the Labor Department today. Headline CPI increased 0.4% in September. But let's take out that volatile food and energy. The core CPI increased 0.2% and 4%. The annual level was the lowest in 2 years, down from 4.1 in September. So Fed future traders took any Fed rate hikes in December and January completely off the table. And the Fed looks smart for effectively ending its tightening cycle as inflation continues to slow. And this is from Bryce Doty, a SIT fixed income advisor. For all of you who have fixed income out there, this is the guy you listen to. The flat reading on headline CPI came as energy prices declined 2.5% for the month, offsetting a 0.3% increase in the food index. But shelter costs, pretty key component in the index, rose 0.3% in October. Half the gain in September, but as a year-over-year increase eased at 6.7%, Dave.
Yeah, interestingly, Melody, within that category, owner's equivalent rent, which we know gauges what property owners would get for rent, increased 0.4%. And a subcategory of that category includes hotel and motel pricing. That dropped just shy of 3%. Former chief economist at PIMCO, Paul McCauley, who's now a professor at Georgetown University, said, "This is a game changer."
Oh, please.
We're having a day of rational exuberance.
It's irrational. It's
yes,
irrational.
The data clearly show what we've been waiting for a long time, which is a crack in the shelter component. Well, whatever. Vehicle costs, which was a key inflation piece, especially during the pandemic spike in 2021 and 2, during the month. New vehicle prices declined ever so slightly by 0.1%. While used vehicles are actually down 0.9% and 7.1% from a year ago. That's actually decent news for consumers.
Yeah, but let me ask you a question, Dave. How high did used vehicle prices actually rise?
They went pretty high.
Yeah, so 7% is nothing.
Well, no.
I mean, if they went up 25% and they're down 7%, they're still pretty high.
Well, no, but if it's the start of a trend.
Oh, well, that's the question. That's the big question. So to think that is the start of a trend?
Well, as someone who's going to be in the market to get a new used car in the not too distant future, I hope so. But from my humble position as a market observer, I'd be surprised if we see a continuing slide to this extent anyway. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if consumer demand puts pressure on these used car dealers to bring prices down. But, I'm talking about I think you're going to see this 7% figure decline to 6, 5, 4, and then maybe it steadies out at 2 or 3 for a few more months until it settles down at its new level, whatever that is, before going up again. We shall see. It'd be fun to follow that and see if I remember what I'm saying here today.
Yeah, and it all makes, sense and so forth. But on the other hand, prices will come down because you're right. People don't have the money to buy the prices that they do. So it's kind of like, how do you see this picture? If people were doing great in the economy and the money was flowing and everything, they'd be paying these prices. So what is really bringing down the prices? Was it actually the higher interest rates, that Federal Reserve that was actually in control of it? Or is it just the economy, another reflection of the increased interest? So where is the economy headed versus these numbers? And what's interesting, these numbers, the used cars, they were never in the inflation equation until the pandemic. So everything is really skewed as far as what is the real inflation number.
Well, that's one of
no one knows.
That's one of government's tricks. Every 10, 15, sometimes 20 years, they change their methodologies. I know we have some people who follow that kind of stuff. In the case of inflation anyway, that using methodologies that were in place in the 80s and then in the 90s, inflation is probably a lot higher than it's currently measured. Even though it's much better than the 9.1% it was last year, it still ain't. It feels higher than what they're telling us it is. Let's put it that way.
Well, because it comes to the food and energy, and that's the part. It's a big deal. Our gasoline prices went down, but everything else, our power bills and everything else is just skyrocketing.
Yes. That's all.
Yep, that's it for that. And that good old American consumer, they don't seem to be snapping back into their pre-pandemic comfort, that low, stable inflation is the normal state of things. Inflation expectations are sometimes self-fulfilling, maybe, to the extent Americans view elevated inflation as a long-term condition. It could make it more likely to come true. I don't know about that, or it could require the Federal Reserve to undertake more painful action to overcome inflationary momentum. And never, ever in any of these inflation views and discussions and analysts analysis, they never talk about what really pushes inflation over a long period of time, and that's our money. That's our monetary policy. That is never brought into the equation. And you know what? Maybe I could believe some of these reports and so forth if they did that. If they would say, hey, this is, but they can't, they won't, and you got to figure it out on your own by trying to understand the way it really works. And Americans expect a 3.6 inflation over the next year. This is according to the Survey of Consumer Expectations. That's down from, of course, the 2022 levels. It's been hovering between 3.6%, Dave, and 3.7%. In 2019, that expectation averaged about 2.6, Dave, 2.6%.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Melody. I'm distracted by Fred. You mentioned something about money supply, and I just wanted to take a quick gander at what it's doing. And it's still. We're at. Where are we here? We're at $20.7 trillion, according to the St. Louis Fed. Still way above where we were. Before the pandemic began at $15.3 trillion. down slightly from the all-time high of 22 trillion money supply, M2.
Oh, money supply. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I want to take a look into that and see how that correlates with, inflationary trends over the same period. But in any event, the survey respondents expected inflation over the next 5 years edged down to 2.7% in October from 2.8% the prior month. Still remains higher than it was last summer, when 2% was the median long-term inflation expectation. Again, this is a highly volatile survey. It changes from quarter to quarter, certainly from year to year. But it does. We don't want to get into this because it has a life of its own. But in theory, the relationship between expectations and actual inflation results is, they call it murky. In theory, people expecting high inflation will push harder for wage increases and be willing to pay a little bit more on the expectation they'll be even higher in the future. Now, if those forces are deeply ingrained, it could prevent inflation from continuing to march downward to the Fed's target, assuming consumer behavior follows that. But in practice, it turns out consumer expectations don't do a great job at predicting it. For example, throughout the 2010s, the New York Fed survey showed Americans persistently expected inflation around 3%, yet it never materialized with inflation, at least as reported, was below 2%. So, again, we'll see where all this leads.
Well, it's interesting, too, surveys.
Yeah.
Hey Joe, what do you think your commission's gonna, what do you think inflation's going to be, in this term, surveys. How real are they? How do they, I know they qualify, the so forth and whatnot, but how legitimate can they really be? It's a survey. They tell us all the time that there's so many surveys, Anyway, they need to change. Pardon?
This next article is pretty important, as are some other happenings today in Washington, as we're hearing.
Yeah. Well, it's about the bank regulators are in front of the Senate and the House committees today and tomorrow. The bank regulation has historically been dominated by technocrats rather than by elected politicians. Maybe this time it might be different. The last big change to global bank regulation, Basel III, took place in the aftermath of the global financial crisis of 08 and 09. But given the degree to which the crisis was caused by grossly excess leverage and risk-taking at these financial institutions, not to mention the hundreds of billions or more that governments spend bailing out the banks, there was little political appetite to oppose tougher bank regulation back then. Domestic political attention was also focused on the Dodd-Frank regulatory reforms, and which required congressional approval rather than on meetings in Basel, Switzerland. So the latest effort to lessen risk in the banking system, dubbed Basel Endgame, has become much more politicized here in the United States. I kind of like that Basel end game. It's the end game. It's a little frightening, isn't it?
I know. That's not a self-fulfilling prophecy or expectation.
I'm sure it is. In September, all of the Republicans on the House Financial Service Committee sent a letter to the Fed urging that its end game proposals be withdrawn, Dave.
Yeah, all Republicans on Sunday in the Senate followed suit, the letter making virtually the same demands, strongly leans into a new talking point from the banking lobby that the rules would hurt everyday Americans. Letter reads in part, as proposed, Basel III will restrict billions of dollars in capital from those who need it most, resulting in costlier and more limited access to credit for millions of Americans.
I hear the music, and we can finish that up when we get back from the break. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom. And our telephone number at Discount Gold and Silver is 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com. dgscoins.com. We had some really interesting questions from people calling in today. And you know, again, I hear the sayings, people want grams, little grams. And I'm thinking grams of gold. And it's like, really? Do you know what country you're living in? You know, look at our education. People can't add one and one together and you want to deal with something in grams. I mean, come on, wake up. You're not living in Europe. You're living here in the United States. You don't want grams. Oh, well, I can break them up into little pieces. No. Gold is your savings account. Silver is your checking account. You're not going to be breaking up your gold into little pieces to use it. It's not going to happen. So, you know, think about this stuff. And I'm really glad that he brought this up to me, because then he ended up buying 1 ounce coins, which is what he should have been purchasing. Those grams, people charge so much more than what you can buy a 1 ounce for. So, and it's a gram. Even the 1/10th ounce American Gold Eagles is better than a gram. And you pay less, usually, for your gold. So, you know, these are the questions I appreciate when folks call and ask me, because there's a lot of misinformation floating around out there, and we're here to help. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. Heading into the break, Dave, we were talking about the bank regulators. Anything you'd like to finish up on that, Mr. Dave?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I don't want to call out one side because the other side I don't know is any better. I don't like when a group of them end up being little more than a mouthpiece for certain lobbyist groups, which it seems like what's going on here largely. I mean, broadly speaking, the Fed's plans, both in Basel III and in the end game, have been to raise the amount of capital or equity that banks have to hold in general, and that too big to fail banks have to hold in particular. The logic is that raising bank capital requirements is the easiest and most effective way to make banks safer. But the greater the bank's equity, the lower their profits become as a percentage of that equity. And that doesn't sit well with bank shareholders who care much about return on equity, because that affects their share price. In any event, bank executives are answerable to the shareholders and are often large shareholders themselves, particularly the too big to fails. The bank lobby, therefore, can be counted on to oppose any capital increase anywhere, anytime. Oh, excuse me. In any event, the standard playbook when opposing an increase in capital requirements is to say that such requirements would make banks less competitive and credit more expensive. Sometimes that's even true, but not a lot. But I'll tell you what makes them less competitive even more is allowing the largest bank in the United States, JP Morgan Chase, to acquire a failed First Republic Bank, to acquire its assets. That doesn't help competition. And it certainly doesn't help jobs. I'll have more on how big banks are fueling financial disaster, Melody, in today's third segment.
All right. And briefly, you know, again, we got, I think, till Friday until government shuts down. Anyway, the funding deadline, which means Friday. And again, we'll have to see what happens here. And so, you know, D.C. is defunct, is just so, just, there's just, it's so, I don't know, Dave. It's like, here
dysfunctional
we are.
Almost sounds, do this. Sounds too polite anymore, you know?
I know. That's, we all agree that it is. So what's the next step, you know? So, I don't know. We'll have to see what happens. I hear they want to do a partial funding and then fund it through February.
Well, I'll tell you what, you now have members apparently elbowing one another in the hallowed halls of Congress, standing up and challenging each other to fight in front of television cameras. I don't think that bodes well for any kind of agreement right now, when, you know, a lot of this fighting is within the same party even. So stop tormenting us, politicians. Come to your senses. Or electors, come to yours.
Yeah, just crazy. So here we go down the same baloney that we do all the time. Anyway, Hyundai and Honda, they're the latest automakers to announce wage hikes. They're going to increase hourly wages for its factory workers 25% by 2028. I think they'd rather do that than have a strike and deal with the unions, because they're getting by with 25 instead of 40%. But anyway, it's going to apply to production teams at the South Korean automakers' Alabama and Georgia factories. There you go, listeners. those of you in Alabama and Georgia, you know what to do with all that extra money. Buy gold and silver. The president of Hyundai said Hyundai continuously strives to maintain competitive wages and benefits. As early as 2024, production workers will have an increase 14% over the past year. The Alabama plant are also able to progress their wages to the top rate within 2.5 years. So the strike, Dave, is a domino effect.
Yeah, I mean, Honda is going to hike the pay of some of its U.S. employees by, they say, 11%. While non-union automakers race to boost pay and keep the union out of its gates, the UAW looks like it's trying to organize foreign-owned factories in the U.S., along with Tesla and Rivian Automotive. On his Facebook page, UAW told employees that, listen to this, Toyota, Honda, Hyundai, Tesla, Nissan, BMW, Mercedes, Subaru, Volkswagen, Mazda, and Rivian, whew, that there is a, quote, better life out there. Join our movement and join the UAW, end quote.
Wow.
Honda spokesperson Chris somebody said that, sorry, Chris, that in addition to the pay raise, the company would shorten progression time for production associates, the time it takes to get to the next step. He also said Honda's added 10 new benefits, including childcare reimbursement, student loan repayment help. It said the highest wage or the wage hike will increase 9.2% in January.
You know, I was having a conversation, and this says where, you know, Honda has student loan repayment programs. And, you know, I had a discussion about where, you know, these companies will throw that in as far as a benefit. If they work there for 10 years, they'll, you know, repay their student loans. Does the government give them, it does keep them from bettering and moving on to a better job. So it keeps them controlled into that position for those, you know, however long that agreement is with the company that they move into. But I wonder if the government gives companies a better deal
to
repay those loans. I don't know. I mean,
I doubt it.
Government always gives subsidies to corporations. So
yeah, but I
don't know how we could find out.
I think we'd know about it. I'll look into it, but I'm guessing almost certainly not.
Well, I don't know. I've never heard anybody ask that question before, though, either. So.
All right, we'll check into it.
Yeah. So, but, you know, we also have this. It was a pretty intense year for labor unrest. And the 48 employees who make up the field staff of the National Education Association, the teachers union, they voted unanimously yesterday to, hey, let's get on board with the strike. The NEA is the largest union in the country, representing about 3 million education professionals from preschool to graduate school. They've actually been without a contract since May of this year. So the vote by the Association of Field Service Employees is perhaps the latest sign of the strong labor resurgence. So the AFL and the CIO is facing similar issues with the union that represents its staff. And, you know, we reported on this last month. So unless the NEA and its staffers reach a deal this week, a 2-day strike would begin Friday at midnight and with the picket line in Atlanta at an NEA conference. You know, 2-day strike's no big deal, Dave.
No.
Is it?
No. Anything longer would certainly be a distraction for the union. They're already working with an ongoing teacher strike in Portland. They're also working in Florida to fend off efforts in that state to curb union power. I don't think this is too much of a big deal, but I think what it does show is that Even union workers at the staff level want a piece of the action that they work on with the, you know, various professionals out there in the field.
Well, you know, there's a warning out there that America's trucking industry is in a dire strait. We talk about this, the trucking industry, for, we've been talking about it for a long time. And because the trucking industry pretty much serves as an indicator of the mood of you buyers out there, of consumers, and, you know, what you spend, especially heading into the holiday season. Post-pandemic, there's been a surplus of trucks and drivers compared to the amount of freight that needs transporting. And we talked about this, I think, I don't know, a couple days ago, Dave. When you look at, you know, like the Panama Canal, I mean, they're backlogged. They're cutting their transportation through the canal by, what, 40, 50% because of the drought? That means products coming to the West Coast of the United States isn't coming, or it's going to be delayed for the holidays. When I was in Home Depot earlier this week, I talked about this yesterday, very little supplies, very little Christmas. So I don't know if it's the product isn't there. Going into grocery stores, you still see food lacking the shelves. They're not full like they used to be. So things have changed and people are getting used to it. And JKC Trucking co-owner Mike Kujarski noted, as lockdown spending slowed and the cost of living continues to rise, more truckers are fighting for the same loads. He said, this is not a good time to be in the trucking industry. Just to paint a picture, the trucking industry is the engine that drives the American economy forward. We're fueling growth and prosperity by transporting goods to where they need. When that engine breaks down or stops, it works like a heart. When that ceases to be, it brings the entire economic system to a halt. Yellow Corporation, for example, which is one of the new nation's oldest and largest trucking companies, we reported on this, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy back in August, laying off 30,000 employees.
Yikes. And there's Convoy, a Seattle-based trucking startup that was valued by investors at $3.8 billion just last year, shut down last month. But because volumes are down, we may even see more trucking companies go out of business. Kucharski, who, by the way, shouldn't be confused with Monster Inc.'s Mike Kowalski, observes. Kucharski explained that freight volumes are a critical indicator of the status of the industry as well as the economy. But he said right now the industry's experienced volume volatility, meaning that volume and rates are down due to supply and demand. He added, we had COVID, we had a huge surplus of spending, and we didn't have enough truckers to move it. Now, everybody, the consumers, have depleted their funds and they're not buying as much. And of course, the prices of everything, including energy and food, have skyrocketed. Consumers are beginning to buy less and truckers are fighting over freight to make some profit or to break even or just to survive another year. Whew. It's a tough.
Well, we just reported on what? The shipping container company.
Yeah.
They're laying off how many thousands of people? They were up into 30,000, I believe. 10,000, 30,000. Their profit went from, you know, something stupid to like like 500 million from, I don't know, 10, 20 billion. I mean, it was an incredible drop. Well, if their prices are dropping, there isn't the cargo coming to the States in order for these truckers to move. So.
Nope.
So how are prices going to come down in so many things?
Some other factor.
Yeah. So, it's interesting. This one just cracked me up. The Supreme Court rolls out code of ethics. And you know what just amazes me? How can anyone, I mean... You would think both sides, any justice, would already have a code of ethic. You know?
Yeah, I was shocked to learn last year, whenever we started hearing about some of the escapades that the Supreme Court, the Supremes didn't have their own code.
I mean, come on. Just by being a Supreme Court justice should automatically be held to a higher standard. But this is where we've become. We've just come to accept these things along the way. And you know, trust me, these escapades have been happening for a long time. And not just in the Senate. How about all of D.C.?
Yeah, talk about the appearance of being above the law. Oh, my gosh.
I hear music. We'll be right back.
Going down to take a look at me. Come on, baby. Don't say baby. I've got to know if your sweet love is going to save me. We may lose and we may win, but we will never be here again. So open up.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody's taking care of other client business this segment. Call her at 1-800-375-4188. You know, at last week's debate featuring the second-tier Republican presidential candidates, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie took aim at rich people, stating they shouldn't be collecting Social Security. He said, I don't know if Warren Buffett's collecting Social Security, but if he is, shame on you. You shouldn't be taking the money. To deal with the issue of expensive entitlements, Christie made a case for raising the retirement age for younger workers and controlling eligibility for Social Security benefits. He ruled out the possibility of raising taxes to fund the program. He called on voters to remember why Social Security was established in the first place. As a safety net to make sure that no one would go old in this country in poverty. Is Christie right to call out millionaires and billionaires who might be collecting retirement benefits who, like the rest of working Americans, contributed their share to Social Security trust funds during their working lives? Social Security is funded through a dedicated payroll tax, 6.2% of wages up to a certain limit. that both employers and employees pay. Another 1.45% is paid by both for Medicare Part A, the hospitalization part. Under federal law, the SSA, the Social Security Administration, sets a limit of the amount of earnings subject to taxation each year in line with the National Average Wage Index. In 2023, the taxable maximum is $160,200, and the resulting maximum Social Security tax is $9,932. Next year, the wage base limit will increase to $168,600, and the max tax will be $10,453. It's still petty cash for billionaires, right? Unlike the Social Security tax, there is no maximum wage limit for the Medicare piece of it. But if you earn more than $200,000 in a calendar year, your employer has to withhold an additional 0.9%. If you earn more than one taxable maximum for Social Security in any year, whether that's at one job or more or more than one, you only be taxed up to those thresholds. So the maximum you'll pay into the system is the same if you earn $170,000, $1.7 million, you know, $17 million, what have you. It's quite beneficial for the nation's wealthiest individuals because it means they end up only paying Social Security tax on a small portion of their earnings when most Americans pay taxes on 100% of their earnings. In the interesting case of Buffett, who's kept his annual salary in a relatively modest $100,000 for the past 40 years, technically mean that he's been below the Social Security wage limit since 2008. Excuse me. But the Berkshire Hathaway co-founder has received a lot of additional income in director's fees and security costs over the years that have lifted his earnings way above the threshold. Now, you may be thinking, what about the rest of Buffett's vast riches? Well, significant portion of his income comes from capital gains on his investment portfolio, which, importantly, isn't considered earnings for Social Security purposes. Now, if you're age 62 or older and you've worked and paid Social Security taxes for 10 years or more, you're eligible to receive retirement benefits, regardless of whether you're a millionaire or you're living paycheck to paycheck. As of September this year, there are almost 67 million Social Security claimants, as we're called, receiving an average monthly benefit of $1,706. That equates to $20,472 per recipient per year, or for this year anyway, which is far more meaningful for those who earned a lower income than those who earned mighty six or seven figure salaries. The earliest Americans can start claiming Social Security is 62, but those who opt to delay until they hit their full retirement age of 66 to 67, depending on your birth year, will receive higher monthly payments, with the maximum benefits available to those who wait to claim when they're 70 or older. Those who reached full retirement age of 67 this year would receive a maximum monthly benefit of about $3,627. But if you started claiming at 62 this year, the maximum monthly payment you'd get is $2,572, 29% less. Well, if you wait until 70 to start collecting benefits, you could have claimed a maximum monthly sum of up to $4,555. Almost 2,000 more a month than those who are claiming it at 62. Now, Social Security benefits in 2024 are projected to rise, and a working retirement at full retirement age will receive $3,822 a month. What's that, 3.2% higher? But if you decide to retire early, age 62, you're going to get $2,710. If you wait, you'll get a maximum monthly check of, well, minimum of $4,873, not including cost of living increases that occur between now and then. But while rich Americans can easily wait until 70 to claim the maximum benefit, many, many, many more feel the need to claim early, despite the financial penalty, to help them get by. Well, Social Security costs the government, the taxpayers, a lot of money. It's the largest category of federal spending, along with health care, and it's drawing a lot of critical eyeballs amid the nation's gross public debt of $33+ trillion. Deficits in the program are projected to increase as more baby boomers retire and swell the ranks for retirement recipients. The number of Americans in that age and retirement bracket is projected to grow another 29% over the next 13 years, from about 58 million last year to about 75 million by 2035. Christie and fellow candidate Nikki Haley both propose increasing the retirement age for younger workers without cutting benefits for current seniors, but they didn't give a specific age, explaining it would come down to negotiations with Congress. Now, as well as limiting the retirement age for younger workers, Haley would also like to limit benefits on the wealthy. She added, that's how we'll deal with entitlement reform and how we'll bring down that debt. Now, I'm not so sure she's right about the debt, but that's a story for another day. And yes, our latest American Survival newsletter has hit the streets. It features Melody's weekly financial market recap, Doug Nolan's weekly credit bubble bulletin, and apothecary herb Wendy Wilson's food for thought column on telepathy. It's an interesting piece. I have an article called Big Banks Fueling Financial Disaster. And once again, Pam and Russ Martin have grabbed my attention with another zinger. In yesterday's Wall Street on Parade newsletter, they feature Michael Hsu, the acting director of the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, OCC. The OCC charters, regulates, and supervises national banks, federally chartered savings associations, and federal branches and agencies of foreign banks in the U.S. They stand beside the Federal Reserve as the major regulator of banking institutions. Specifically, the Martins write about how Hsu undermined already declining public trust in the U.S. banking system when he approved J.P. Morgan Chase's acquisition of failed First Republican Bank in May. By now, readers know that J.P. Morgan is America's largest and, by some measures, riskiest bank in the nation. The Martins go on to note that Hsu's response to that collapse in public trust was to, yes, issue a survey measuring public trust in, yes, again, banks. Martins tie much of Americans' lack of trust to the number of unlawful acts committed by the largest of the too big to fails over the last 23 years. They report that the six largest Wall Street banks have been subject, listen to this, to 490 legal actions, leading to more than $207 billion in fines and settlements over that period. Now, not all of those 490 were felonies. A lot of them are misdemeanors, but still. Numbers according to the nonprofit, nonpartisan firm Better Markets. According to one of their October press releases entitled Wall Street's Rap Sheet, quote, year after year, Wall Street's biggest banks continue to rip off, discriminate against, and financially endanger their customers. Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and Wells Fargo have racked up more than $9 billion in fines in just the past 15 months, unquote. Among their 2023 ignoble deeds, in May, Wells Fargo agreed to pay shareholders $1 billion to settle a class action lawsuit, alleging the bank misled investors and public about its response to allegations that the bank was improperly opening accounts without customer permission. It's an old story. In May, Goldman Sachs agreed to pay $215 mil to settle a class action lawsuit that claimed the bank discriminated against women employees' pay, performance evaluations, and promotions. In June, J.P. Morgan Chase agreed to pay about $290 mil to settle a class action suit by victims of Jeffrey Epstein that claimed the bank facilitated Epstein's crimes. In July, the OCC and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau collected $250 mil from Bank of America for illegally charging junk overdraft fees, withholding credit card rewards, and opening fake accounts. In August, Citigroup agreed to pay a $2.9 million fine to the SEC to settle charges that the bank's broker-dealer unit intentionally violated record-keeping requirements. Again in August, Morgan Stanley agreed to pay the equivalent of $6.8 million to the United Kingdom to settle allegations that its traders used banned applications that violated certain requirements. And in September, Goldman Sachs agreed to pay the Commodities Futures Trading Commission a $30 million fine for failing to diligently supervise a wide range of its swap dealer activities. Oh, and on and on and on it goes. The rap sheet release adds, quote, while banks portray themselves as upstanding entities with a primary mission of helping Americans fulfill their financial dreams, in truth, they each have a dark side as unrepentant recidivists breaking virtually every financial law and rule imaginable, often multiple times. The bank's ongoing, repeated, and unlawful conduct directly impacts the wallets and lives of Main Street Americans, many of whom are vulnerable and simply unable to bear the losses when they are victimized, end quote. Perhaps Sue himself is more than undermining public trust by his seemingly cavalier approval of Morgan's acquisition of First Republic in the spring. Indeed, as the Martins point out, Sue and Washington's dysfunctional culture in general is, as Senator Elizabeth Warren warned over the summer, courting disaster. Their article describes the Office of Financial Research's so-called contagion index. The OFR is a branch of the U.S. Treasury Department whose responsibility it is to promote financial stability by delivering high-quality financial data, standards, and analysis, principally to support the Financial Stability Oversight Council. Or, as the Martins characterize it, the OFR serves as an early warning system for serious cracks in financial stability. The contagion index measures how specific a too-big-to-fail bank default could result in a systemic contagion in the U.S. banking system as a result as of its interdependence and leverage. Well, as of the end of the second quarter, J.P. Morgan Chase represented three times more of the potential contagion as Bank of America, the second largest bank in the U.S. of A. It's no way to run the financial system of a banana republic, much less the United States of America. As longtime readers know, I'm a strong believer in fundamental governmental reform, but in this case, I just can't say it any better than how the Martins concluded their column yesterday. They said, quote, until corporate and Wall Street billionaire funding of political campaigns is outlawed by congressional legislation, or I might add, very unlikely constitutional amendments. Until Wall Street's revolving door is slammed shut, until the U.S. president stops nominating and the Senate stops confirming partners at Wall Street's law firms to run the U.S. Department of Justice, this is the corrupt predatory banking system that every American will be forced to attempt to navigate. Amen to that, Martins. Amen to that. Whew. Gets my ire going. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I'll return on Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs, talking about telepathy. Thanks, as always, to our production extraordinaire, Todd Waite, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a great evening. Bye-bye. That's too bad.